This free program is paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a member, think about joining with us to help keep free speech alive.
Welcome to the New Capital Show. I'm Leo Gold, your host. A pleasure to be with you here. This will be the last show of the year, and we've had a great year here on the show. We were named Best of Houston by the Houston Press, Best Local Talk Show. And, of course, the show is now going out over Apple iTunes. You can subscribe to it there, podcasting, www.newcapitalshow.com. You can also subscribe there directly and other podcast directories. And hopefully we'll be coming to other cities as well in the upcoming year. We're working on that. I hope you've had a great year. It's been, as I say, a great year here for the New Capital Show and for KPFT, and we're looking forward to another great year, which is going to be culminating, of course, with an American presidential election next year. It should be very, very exciting, and I frankly look forward to bringing you all the news as it changes and transforms and new developments occur. Of course, the big development this morning, if you were just listening to Democracy Now!, is that Benazir Bhutto, the opposition prime minister in Pakistan, was assassinated today. And, of course, this just brings to mind always that violence is not an answer. Violence is not an answer to organizing a society. Violence is a strike against democracy. It's a strike against the free will of people to speak and to be heard, for people to vote. And those who perpetrate violence, whatever the reason, whatever the motivation, often the consequences are totally unintended. I'm sure that we will see other democratic leaders who will rise in Pakistan to replace Benazir Bhutto and pick up the flag and speak out for democracy. Of course, the United States has undertaken violent measures, especially in Iraq, over the past 5 years. In this case, an unmotivated attack in Iraq, which has resulted in large amounts of violence there. Of course, people homeless, dead, and yet another warning that violence is not the solution. Of course, the great leader at one time of Pakistan was Mahatma Gandhi, when Pakistan and India were one country. This was before Pakistan broke away to become a separate country, largely populated by ethnic Muslims. But at one time, Mahatma Gandhi, the great leader of the nonviolence movement worldwide, was the leader and the founder of, could really be considered the founder of modern Pakistan. And we are quite certain that Gandhi's principles are at work in all segments of Pakistani culture, and that democratic hearts, democratic minds will prevail in time in Pakistan. Our thoughts go out to the Pakistani people. Of course, as Amy Goodman pointed out, the United States is stepping up its military commitments in Pakistan. And toward that end, President Bush signed a $555 billion bill, signed it into law, was talking about this on last week's show. Some $70 billion of that $555 billion is for war in Afghanistan and in Iraq. If you think about that, that's one-eighth of the federal budget for roughly the next 9 months to a year. One-eighth of it. $1 out of every $8 in tax receipts is going to fund warfare in Iraq and Afghanistan. I truly believe that people in this country are starting to take a look at the expenditures and beginning to do what all investors do. Whenever you look at an investment, you're faced with the question, is the investment that I'm making, what is the opportunity cost? And of course, the opportunity cost is, what is the next best investment that I can make, or what alternative ways could I use the money for? The United States, in the wake of the Second World War, had the strongest economy. In fact, in many ways, it was the only economy left standing in the world, and the U.S. could afford to make expenditures that would result in investments going bad and still survive to tell about it. We live in a very different world right now with competition, and of course, our treasury is not nearly as flush as it was in those post-World War II years. And at some point, and we're already seeing it, at some point we're going to see problems from making poor investments. A couple more news items coming up later in the show will be Thomas Glenn, who works with Environmental Defense. I've had several guests from Environmental Defense on before. Jim Marston, the activist with Environmental Defense, who worked on the TXU deal when it was sold off to two private firms. Jim Marston was on several months back, and Mary Kelly even farther back. We talked about rivers and treatment of rivers. Mary Kelly out of Austin doing a lot of work. And today, Thomas Glenn, who recently joined Environmental Defense, will be talking about his position as clean energy policy specialist here in the Houston area. And we'll be talking about things that are going on in building codes here in Houston to help improve our efficiency in our use of energy. Couple of news items. First, this was really interesting. Capturing carbon with enzymes. Technology review from MIT. A new process turns greenhouse gas into useful materials. All kinds of stuff coming out. I mean, it's not just in news journals like New York Times or Wall Street Journal, but in technical magazines, scholarly technical engineering journals. There's a race on all over the place to bring about greater energy efficiency, to decrease emissions, and this is great. This is terrific. A new way to capture carbon dioxide from smokestacks produces a raw material that can be sequestered underground or turned into substances such as baking soda, chalk, or limestone. CO2 solution of Quebec City, Canada has already tested its process on a small municipal incinerator and an Alcoa aluminum smelter. Its scientists are now working with power plant equipment giant Babcock and Wilcox on ways to adapt the technology to a coal-fired generating station. The company has genetically engineered E. coli bacteria. Now, I understand it's genetically engineered, and who knows? I got you, but hear me out. The company has genetically engineered E. coli bacteria to produce an enzyme that converts carbon dioxide into bicarbonate. The enzyme sits at the core of a bioreactor technology that could be scaled up to capture carbon dioxide emissions from power plants that run on fossil fuels, says Sylvie Fredette. So far we have a small prototype. Next, we have to look at what's necessary for a very large prototype or power plant. So anyway, you get the point. They've genetically modified an enzyme so that it eats carbon dioxide, basically, digests it, and turns it into something else. So all sorts of approaches to this issue of carbon dioxide and how we're going to cut the emission of carbon dioxide into our atmosphere. Here's a genetic enzyme way to do it. And, of course, as I announced last week, a city in Illinois, $1.5 billion or so, is going into a future-gen plant, which is going to try the mechanical way of taking carbon dioxide and sequestering it. Okay, One more thing. Hoover planned mass jailings in 1950, New York Times, December 23rd, speaking of democracy. A newly declassified document shows that J. Edgar Hoover, the longtime director of the FBI, had a plan to suspend habeas corpus and imprison some 12,000 Americans he suspected of disloyalty. Hoover sent his plan to the White House on July 7th of 1950, 12 days after the Korean War began. It envisioned putting suspect Americans in military prisons. Gosh. J. Edgar Hoover. J. Edgar Hoover wanted President Harry S. Truman to proclaim the mass arrests necessary to protect the country against treason, espionage, and sabotage. Of course, this meant communists to Hoover. The FBI would apprehend all individuals potentially dangerous to national security, Hoover's proposal said. The arrests would be carried out under a master warrant attached to a list of names provided by the Bureau. The names were part of an index that Hoover had been compiling for years. The index now contains approximately 12,000 individuals, of which approximately 97% are citizens of the U.S., wrote Hoover. In order to make effective these apprehensions, the proclamation suspends the writ of habeas corpus. Habeas corpus, the right to seek relief from illegal detention, has been a fundamental principle of law for seven centuries. The Bush administration's decision to hold suspects for years at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, has made habeas corpus a contentious issue for Congress and the Supreme Court. And so we have precedent for those in power seeking to suspend habeas corpus, the right to seek relief from illegal detention, the right to appeal to a court that your detention is unwarranted. J. Edgar Hoover seeking to suspend it for 12,000 American citizens whom he simply suspected of disloyalty. This is the person who was in charge of the Federal Bureau of Investigation for decades. And so, as we learn of the death of Benazir Bhutto today, we learn that violence, suspension of rights, these types of things are threats to democracy, and we must stand up, speak out against them, and stand fully for democracy, fully for habeas corpus and the right to seek relief from all sorts of illegal actions. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Thomas Glenn of Environmental Defense, and we will be talking about changing building codes and other things that, frankly, you can do at home. You can do at home to increase your energy efficiency and help the Earth at the same time. This is Leo Gold and the New Capital Show. We'll be back in just a moment. Welcome back to the New Capital Show, www.newcapitalshow.com. I'm Leo Gold, your host, and it is, of course, a pleasure to be back with you as 2007 winds its way down and out. I'm joined by Thomas Glenn. He and I both have small children who have given us every manner of illness going on. Listen to this. Let's just cough it out. Ready? Let's go. Oh, God.
Yeah, that helps, Leo.
Yeah,
we've been dealing with
bowel infections. I just, you know what? Here we are. We're trying to suppress it. You know what? The folks today, Thomas, welcome to the show. It's a pleasure to have you on. You've been with Environmental Defense for a few months now, and you're the clean energy policy specialist. Tell us about what you're doing with Environmental Defense in your new position.
Well, Leo, thanks again for allowing me to come on. I know that it is the end of the year, and it's a tough time for us. People want to take off for vacation. So, again, thank you.
Yep.
I started about 3 months ago here in Houston with Environmental Defense. We're as their clean energy policy specialist. And what that means exactly is really trying to work on energy efficiency initiatives here in the greater Houston area and also clean energy technology opportunities that may be out there.
Now, Environmental Defense is a national organization. So do you have counterparts in other cities in the country who are doing the same kind of thing you are?
From what I understand, not directly.
Mm-hmm.
We have some folks that are doing energy efficiency advocacy programs throughout the country, but no one that was particularly hired just to do just this.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm not mistaken, I may be the first and maybe, you know, the initial guinea pig, but it's
terrific.
One of the goals for the organization is to make this a primary program within our clean air program. Energy efficiency, we believe, goes hand in hand with clean air.
Okay, so it's the clean energy policy specialist position is part of the clean air initiative in Environmental Defense. And, of course, it's probably no coincidence that it's here in Houston that the clean air initiative would be taking place. Is that correct? Because we've got issues.
Well, Houston historically has had issues, and we all know what those reasons are. But one of the main reasons why we started the initiative here in Houston, because Houston, the greater Houston area, is the biggest consumer of electricity in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And that's obvious because, you know, the city and the region is also the biggest engine driver of the state.
Mm-hmm. And we have a large
significant population.
And a large industrial base.
Residential, well, commercial, and industrial. So we have large bases here in Houston for those three initiatives, if you will. And we're believing that if we can start here in Houston, maybe we can try to take it statewide.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So what is it that is specifically you are tasked with as part of this clean energy policy program, and what are the sort of tasks that you are looking at and trying to help with, and who are you helping? Who are you communicating with the ideas of the Environmental Defense Organization?
Well, great questions, without a doubt. We are primarily tasked, with working with the city of Houston. And when those opportunities present themselves after we continue to work with the city.
Is this the mayor's office?
Not necessarily just the mayor's office. It's going right down to the staff level in regards to Public Works Department in regards to their building codes for residential and commercial energy codes.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can see the city of Houston adopt some new codes come 2008. Be honest with you, that is a process that the city began prior to my actually coming onto this position, so I can't take credit for them actually doing that.
Right.
We've been involved with that process as far as providing input. But if we can get the city to adopt some new codes, the hope and the goal is obviously to get other cities in the region to follow suit. Not necessarily to follow exactly what the city does, but you want to make sure that you do something that works for your city, but at the same time still addresses energy efficiency and, for that matter, clean air in the region.
Okay, so the city of Houston has undertaken, as we've described on this program before, to upgrade its building codes.
Correct.
That's been going on. And so do you come in and say, you know, we want to review these, we want to we want to comment on these on behalf of the environmental group, Environmental Defense, and our constituents? We want to add to these or take something away? Is it that kind of dialogue that goes on?
It is that kind of dialogue and then some in regards to just providing background information in regards to what other cities across the country have done that the city of Houston staff may not have access to because, be honest about it, their time is limited.
Okay, so give us an example of something that's been done in another city that we're kind of missing the boat on, at least in this building code upgrade.
Mm, for example, and I always remind people that, you know, we're not like this city, but, you know, the city of Austin, of course, is one of the more greener cities that we have in the state, if not the country. And they recently have undertaken adoption, for that matter, of new building codes for residential and commercial. There are some issues within those codes that, you know, in essence, that
in the Austin code.
In the Austin codes, yeah, that the city of Houston may or may not want in regards to insulation in office buildings or the type of roofing that you may have on a home, as far as what some people may term a cool roof, to make, you know, to lower the amount of heat that's coming into the home. Well, that may work for Austin, and the city of Houston may want to look into it, but that may not necessarily work for Houston. So we may try to provide input to the city of Houston about, well, this works for Austin because of this, but if you tweak it this way, you know, lower the threshold and the amount of insulation that you have to put on top of a roof, for instance, or the the roofing insulation itself, the process, it may work better because you're in a hot and humid climate, which is a lot more humid than it is in Austin.
Yeah. Okay, well, look, there's a lot going on in building green. I mean, we're seeing it in magazines. It's almost hard to pick up a publication these days now and not see something on going green, especially in terms of construction. And so what are some of the items that people can undertake in their own homes? We've talked about this with some recent guests. What are some things that people can do to upgrade the environmental efficiency of their homes? And you and I were talking before the show about the type of investment payoff. Mm-hmm. Generally, when you look at an investment, if you can get an investment paid off in a handful of years, that's a good investment. If it's going to take 20 years to pay off an investment, probably not going to be a good investment. So generally speaking, a handful of years is a good investment. What are some of the things that we're now seeing in environmental systems or just upgrades that can go on with a house that provide these types of payoffs and that people should really take a look at?
Well, for instance, with homes, on residential homes, a lot of the things that are being discussed today, even though it may be catchy, for instance, or, you know, and like you were saying, there's a lot of stuff that's out there. Everybody wants to be green. And you don't necessarily want to just go green just because of going green. For some people, that's, you know, you're following a trend.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our goal, if you're going to do it right, and, you know, you're going to help save the earth for as clean air goes. But at the same time, our organization wants you to do things correctly that's going to also make more sense economically for you. A lot of the technology that's going on now has been out there for years. I mean, it's simple things like put more insulation in your attic, stuff that I'm sure engineers and architects been trying to advise people for years to do, increase the amount of insulation in the attic. Or, for that matter, you may have a 10 or 15 or 20-year-old home that has had its AC updated or changed. Or, for that matter, you haven't had someone come in and just basically do a $200 furnace check.
Mm-hmm.
To make sure that your AC or your heat pump is operating.
Yeah, one of our guests a few weeks ago was really emphasizing this, that enormous losses occur through the air conditioning systems here. Duct work that's leaking, furnace joints and joints using duct tape and so forth that's not efficient. So you would advise that. You would think that people could really significantly cut their bills and demand less energy if they would undertake to really totally check out their air conditioning system and make sure that it's in tip-top shape.
And we advise people, I mean, if we had to provide advice to an individual, a residential homeowner, just do the simple things. The things that you really ought to be doing anyway as a homeowner, just to be able to have uptake, upkeep on your home. It could be as simple as changing the incandescent light bulb to a CFL to, again, adding on new insulation into your roof, I mean, into your attic, or replacing the roof that is, you know, darn well has been outdated, or for that matter, in need of replacement.
You're saying the whole roof, shingles and all that.
Some people,
stuff.
I mean, you're talking, I mean, this region, even though we're building a lot of new homes and have a lot of people coming into the region, probably somewhere in the neighborhood about 100,000 a year, this region is still composed of a majority of existing home stock. Mm-hmm. Some of those homes in that stock is probably well over 30 years old. You're looking at anywhere between homes being valued between $50,000 to probably $110,000 or so. And to be honest about it, you really are talking about folks that are trying to get by. They're doing the best they can with their families, but may not have the extra $200 or $400 or $500 sitting around
to do a few things. What do they do? What does a family like that do? Do they need to take the long view and say, we need to make this investment because it's a long-term investment? Or how can they see the savings immediately from making the investment in upgrading their homes from this housing stock?
I mean, obviously, the way you see the immediate investment being made is through that light bill that you get every month from whatever provider that you have in this region. I mean, when I first moved back here in January 2006, and I was quite aware of electric deregulation before I got here, I was just amazed to be in an apartment for 3 to 6 months, and our electric utility bill was, I don't know, almost $250 for probably barely a 600 to 700 square foot apartment when I just left a home in Austin that had over 1,400 square feet, and I never saw electric utility bill go past $80. So obviously, if you're living in an older home here in this region, that if you just even change all the light bulbs in your house, and on average most people have between 15 to 35 or so light sockets that mm-hmm. they can change their bulbs, mm-hmm. you're probably going to save, you know, over time, $30 to $50 a month on that light bill just from doing that as time goes on.
So $30 to $50 a month on the light bulbs, that'd be about a few hundred dollars a year. That would pay for the investment pretty much immediately.
Right. Well, and for instance, you come in and you get someone to check your furnace.
Yeah.
And it may blow out some stuff that's been sitting there for 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I wouldn't want to give you an exact dollar figure, but you can almost imagine you spend that $200 now that you're going to recoup that $200 within...
Okay, we're going to take your call, 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. If you're just joining us, Thomas Glenn is my guest today. He is the Clean Energy Policy Specialist for Environmental Defense for the Greater Houston Area. And again, 713-526-5738. Anybody out there have any ideas and you want to join the conversation about what are some of the things that can be done, should be done to a home to increase its energy efficiency? Maybe some of you have some stories about some actual energy savings out there. We'd love to hear from you today. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. Thomas, you came before Environmental Defense. You were working in Austin, and you've been working in legislative positions. You worked for the Lieutenant Governor Ben Ratliff, Bill Ratliff, who was in that position for a couple of years. Tell us about how energy policy gets made, if at all, in Austin. What should people know about energy policy here in the state of Texas and how it gets made at the state level?
Well, like any piece of legislation in Austin, it is a very challenging process to get it passed. You're talking about a system that is designed to fail. But, you know, one of the great things about the system itself is that before the legislature even begins, a lot of those processes have begun. So consumers, environmental groups like ours, electricity companies, public policy persons, and for instance, like the Public Utility Commission, they're going to provide their input to lawmakers about what they believe should be done beforehand, before the session even begins. And it's just an education process before session begins, and as session goes on, that's when the selling job begins.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the current electricity dereg bill that we're operating on under right now, past 1999.
Yeah, and the mayor of Houston says it's a failure. I mean, he's come flat out said that deregulation in Texas, for what it's worth, Bill White, who actually I think was Assistant Secretary of Energy
in
the Clinton administration, said it's a failure. It has resulted for those areas where deregulation has taken effect and has a practical effect, deregulation has brought higher prices. Certainly here in Houston versus places where there are, in Texas, where there are publicly owned utilities and some ability to control their destiny. Is that the general view, at least in the legislature, that you saw, that it's been a failure, or that is there a belief that deregulation has brought any benefit?
There's a belief on both sides that it's been a benefit and a failure. But in regards to our position from environmental defense, I'm, be honest, not in a position to take a stand on that. The one thing that I can say to address that issue is that when Texas deregulated our market in 1999, you had a situation where the bulk of the generation facilities in this state were natural gas generating facilities. And shortly after Texas restructured our market and opened it up to competition, that is when natural gas prices just spiked up because of a whole lot of different issues internationally and nationally that a lot of which we couldn't control. And for that matter, we're still dealing with it today. I'm not going to sit up here and make excuses for electricity companies, but that is one aspect that is out there and that is very true. Whether or not it's been a failure, it, I mean, obviously when you talk to a consumer, they're not too happy when you're talking about going from a $200 light bill every month to an $800 light bill. Again, like I said, when I got here in 2006, to see my electric utility bill go from approximately $80 a month living in Austin in a 1,450-square-foot house, you know, to $200 in a 650-700-square-foot apartment, you know, that got my eyes going because, you know, I was sadly... That's sadly, but I was actually there in 1999. But I was working for Attorney General Cornyn when he was Attorney General and working on a bill from, believe it or not, a consumer protection standpoint because the Consumer Protection Division within the Attorney General's office had a hand in it because we had to work with the Public Utility Commission to make sure that consumers were being, you know, addressed in a bill. So, I mean, that is really up for debate. And I do believe that next regular session in 2009 that members of the legislature will have to address this issue again.
And what is the issue of energy, of electricity deregulation in the state of Texas you think they're going to take up again?
I believe they're going to talk about it again. I don't know if they're actually going to address it because you have a significant part of the membership there that believes that that it's working and the marketplace is working. There are those that are out there that don't believe that.
Okay. 713-526-5738. My guest today is Thomas Glenn, who is with Environmental Defense's Clean Energy Policy Specialist. And let's go to the phones. And first, let's take Mike. Mike, welcome.
Good morning. What a great show you have on today.
Well, thank you.
It's refreshing to hear this topic on something other than one of the home shows
right.
on the weekends, and because it's just such an important topic. I'm a local.
It is. Do you have a story, Mike, on stuff you've done or that you're thinking about doing?
Well, I'm a local home inspector in the area, and this is the kind of stuff that I always share with my client. But one of the things I wanted to ask Thomas is, do you suspect that the radiant barriers will be in the code soon? Because that is that's the third way to reduce heat transfer into the home. You know, insulation, ventilation in the attics is real important. A lot of the older homes don't have that, but the radiant barrier is the third way to reduce heat.
Now, what is that, Mike? Tell everybody what that is.
The radiant barrier is either comes in the form of a plywood, which is an aluminum-infused type plywood that reduces the radiant heat that comes from the sun, and it reduces it significantly by about 75 or 80% into the attic.
So what we're talking about is reflecting the sun off the roof, basically.
Basically, yeah, in essence. The other way to do it, if you have an existing home, an older home, you can get a radiant barrier paint and have a professional company that applies that product come and paint the inside of your attic with the radiant barrier.
What sort of savings do you get? I mean, is this a significant improvement from a shingle roof, plain shingle roof without the radiant barrier?
Yeah, the roof covering has really nothing to do with it. This goes on the interior of the attic.
Right.
And you can still have any kind of roof covering on the exterior. But I believe it's anywhere from about 20 to 30% of reduction. Mm. But the amount of heat it produces is about 80% of the heat coming into the attic. And that's really where your savings comes in, because the less heat you have in your attic, the less heat that transfers down to the home.
Thomas Glenn, what about radiant barriers? What are we getting from the city of Houston and code updates?
Well, Mike, I can't speak to what the city of Houston is going to do in regards to radiant barriers directly. Like I mentioned to Leo prior to our coming on, I haven't had the pleasure of dealing with those committee meetings, if you will, directly. We're blessed with some financial resources to hire a consultant that knows these issues directly to be deeply involved in both processes on the residential and commercial. But I do agree with you. Radiant barriers are a significant part of what homeowners can do for their homes. The key question, again, is whether or not it's going to be cost-effective for, you know, those consumers that are out there that may or may not be able to go just, you know, take that money out of their pocket or, for that matter, go get a loan. Leo, one of the other things I wanted to talk to you about is, you know, another thing that we're hoping that banking institutions may be willing to do more of here in Houston, which is provide more energy efficiency loans. And also energy efficiency mortgages. There are some banks, national banks, that are doing just that in regards to allowing existing homeowners to seek out a new mortgage and rolling in the energy efficiency projects within that new mortgage. There are some savings and loans institutions and credit unions that are also allowing some of their members to take out energy efficiency loans, almost like a personal loan, if you will, to do just those projects that we're talking
about. So they could tap a line of credit from their lending institution for an energy-specific project in the home. I need $10,000 to put a radiant barrier in and upgrade the air conditioning system and change to double E windows and et cetera, et cetera. And with these specific programs, you're saying it's easier to get that loan, and then it's wrapped into the overall the larger mortgage.
Exactly. I mean, and that's one major issue that some of us in our office really believe will be, you know, very beneficial for consumers.
Mm-hmm.
Because not everybody is making $120,000 a year in this region, and some of those people that are even at that level still can't take that money out of their pocket to go do what needs to be done for their home.
Yep. Anything else, Mike?
No, that was great. I appreciate the dialogue.
Thanks for the call. Okay, next up, let's take Guy. Guy, welcome to the New Capital Show. You're on with Thomas Glenn.
Hey, Leo. Thanks for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
I'm Guy Roy. I'm the Healthy Home Guy, and I try a lot to make people's houses healthy, and going green is going to take a lot of work.
Yeah.
It really is. We're going to need pressure systems to keep the attic air out of the house. We're gonna need reversible roofs that go black in winter and white summer. We're gonna need to do a lot of work on these houses, and there's so much wrong with them. They're making kids sick, and it's you know, the best thing you could do is seal up your attic door, seal up your air chase, get inside your air box, caulk it up, make everything sanitary.
Mm-hmm.
Paint over the fiberglass, make it stop fuzzing up the system, getting into kids' lungs. I mean, this needs to be done to make houses healthy.
Thomas Glenn, what about the health issues, not just the energy efficiency issues? Are you addressing those in your approaches to the city of Houston and others that you talk to? Guy brings up, I think, a good point that there are health issues involved as well in the way that we've constructed homes.
Well, I mean, the overall goal of the program is to encompass the health issue into our program. Clean air itself, as we all know, is an essential part of just healthy living. And, you know, it's not just homes. We're also working with school districts on their existing buildings and new schools. One of the things that we were very happy to see was the Houston Independent School District decided to build all 24 of their new buildings, new school buildings, that was passed in his last bond initiative in November as LEED buildings, which is, you know, a higher standard of building. And ultimately, because those buildings are LEED buildings, they're going to be more cleaner and efficient and more importantly, more healthy for the school kids that are within those buildings. It's interesting that all of this really ties, they kind of just go all hand in hand. And mm-hmm. A guy hits on a great point. They really, health in the home, schools, commercial office buildings where employees work, it matters. I mean, it's going to keep people
warm. I mean, Guy, what you're saying is it just makes sense. The less efficient a home is, the more mechanical systems you have to use, the more machines you therefore introduce, the more moving parts, and therefore the more lubricants and insulating barriers and so forth if the house is not designed properly, correct?
Well, that's correct. If you take off a vent in a normal house, you'll find a big sheetrock mistake and a fuzzy fiberglass box full of mold. It's absolutely the norm. It's not a rare sight, and the box inside the air vent is actually made of fuzzy fiberglass.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it actually, that's not the insulation part that sits in the attic. We're talking about inside the AC system.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been some mistakes in the code for years, and it's not being addressed.
You're saying it's not. Is it being? Is it to your knowledge? This. I mean, what I keep hearing is that a new phone book of regulations is coming out here in Houston. I don't know what's going on in other cities. I'm assuming the same discussions are being had in cities across the country.
Well, I sat in on one of those city meetings, and it's slow going. I can assure you.
Yeah.
And I was invited to one of the building code review meetings, and you know, it's a very challenging thing to go through the code piece by piece. A lot of times in the past, they made abrupt changes in the code and got rid of perfectly good equipment. They're trying to make sure they don't do that again.
Mm-hmm.
And ripping out all this fiberglass square duct is not easy, so it's better to paint it or come up with some better solution and caulking it and sealing it, and it needs to be done on an urgent basis.
Mm-hmm.
And for everyone's home, I haven't seen a home that should have passed inspection yet, especially the Good Sense homes. Or the what are they the star or whatever they call it.
Now when you call it
have airtight can lights, how can you call it an Energy Star home if it doesn't seal up the attic stairs?
Yeah.
How can you call it an Energy Star home if it has gaps everywhere? You know, I don't believe it, because it doesn't have an inspection process to go along with it to make sure it's being done right.
Now when you're talking about the fiberglass duct, that's the so-called flex duct, is that right?
No, the flex duct is perfectly safe.
Yeah.
It's the square duct that has the open face fuzzy stuff.
Uh-huh.
It looks like silver. When you look at it in your attic, it looks like silver boxes, but on the inside, it's fuzzy glass.
Mm-hmm.
It's horrible.
So your takeaway here, guys, we got a long, long way to go, and we're in the early innings. We're in the first pitch is being thrown out, maybe.
Yeah, and we've got to do a lot for these buildings. We've got to put pressure systems to reverse the airflow, reversible roofs that change color. We got to add 12-volt AC systems that run for free. You know, we need to do a lot more.
The 12-volt would take advantage of solar connections.
Right, it's just a small system that would pressure the house lightly,
mm-hmm.
you know, a long way towards reversing that infiltration of 100-degree air would already take your standards way up.
Guy, thanks for the call.
Thank you for having me on, Leo.
Yep. 713-526-5738, 713-526-KPFT. We're talking about building standards. We're talking about upgrading our homes and places of business. Of course, there are two main sources of energy consumption in our lives. First is how we get around, our transportation. That's powered, by and large, until it changes, that is powered by oil. And, of course, what we're hoping to see in the future is conversion to other forms of fuel, as well as perhaps cars that plug in to the energy grid and can take advantage there, are battery powered, and therefore get their power not from oil but from battery power or other sources of energy. And of course, the other main source of our energy consumption is where we live. So how we get around and where we live. And where we live, by and large, at least in the United States, some 50-60% is powered by coal. Coal is a very dirty way to get energy. Just think about it. You're sitting there burning it and emitting hopefully only carbon dioxide, but in some cases, at least in China, as new power plants get built in China, they're old-style power plants, and they are emitting sulfur dioxide, nitrous oxide, all sorts of smog and mercury-forming pollutants. And so we're fundamentally facing the need to have an energy revolution in our country to change how we get around and where we live. And today we're talking about the second one, where we live. How can we change our homes to make them more energy efficient, therefore better for our health and for the planet's health? Let's take line 6. Mary, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm, pleasure.
When we're talking about the radiant barrier, I want to ask this question. My co-op, I live northeast of Houston, and I have a co-op, and my co-op claims that its members use more energy heating their houses than they do cooling their houses. So if I put the radiant barrier in, which we did in another house, what am I doing for the winter?
I don't know the answer to that, Thomas. First of all, it's very strange here in Houston to know that you spend more to heat it than cool it, because...
Well, I live outside of Houston, northeast of Houston.
Right.
You know, just a matter of miles.
Right.
And my co-op told me that, and I'm having a hard time believing what my co-op told me.
But, because, I mean, my gosh, we've got, basically, we start warm weather around really late March, even April of this year when the air conditioner comes on. And at least this year, my air conditioner was running in, maybe even had been running in December. I think we had one hot week there where I was just couldn't believe it. It was like maybe second week in December when it got up to like 80-something degrees, and we literally had to flip on the air conditioner because it was uncomfortable in the house. Anyway, Thomas, what do you have for Mary on this radiant barrier question?
Well, Mary, I'm going to be honest. I don't have a good answer to your question, and I think Guy, the gentleman that was on right before, may be in a better position than I. One of the better things that you could do is maybe to get a third-party inspector to come out and help you ascertain what you may need to do because, you know, co-ops and homeowners association may or may not be in the best position to tell you what you need to do for your home.
Well, yeah. I'm not sure the co-op's telling me the truth.
Yeah, maybe. And that's the reason why I was suggesting, you know, maybe getting someone else, like an inspector or, you know, engineers.
No, I'm a complete greener. Mm-hmm. I don't turn my air conditioning on until the middle of August. And I live in the woods, so I can get under the trees and keep cool.
Mm-hmm.
And I barely use any heat whatsoever, and I have one light bulb. So I'm a complete greener, except, well, I live so far in the country. When I go anywhere, I have to drive my car.
Yeah.
You know, great distances, so
yeah.
There's kind of my problem.
But again, I would still suggest that to you. I mean, if you can get a hold of an inspector, someone that you know have been doing something probably for 5 to 10 years or more, or
right.
Family members or good neighbors or friends may have this person come out and do an inspection of their home. Those people are going to be in a good position to make some recommendations to you. And
well, I'm real old, and in the days where we didn't have air conditioning, pre-air conditioning days,
mm-hmm.
we built our houses to be cool. And one of the main things was a high roof where we put vents on the end of each side of the house. We'd be sure we had the house facing the right direction for the winds. And those huge vents on each side of the house can be closed up in the winter,
mm-hmm.
open in the summer, and attic fans and stuff like that kept us really very cool.
Well,
and so if we built houses like that again, instead of these little low roof houses like we do now, so enclosed, I think that we'd just be so much better off.
Mary, thanks for the call.
All right, bye-bye.
Next up, let's take Bobby. Bobby, welcome.
Oh, thanks. I feel like the Vaudeville Act that followed three kids and a dog. Anyway, but my input is kind of be careful what you ask for, because Bobby's axiom number 3 or 4 is purpose of regulation is to benefit the distributors,
mm-hmm.
to sell stuff. Okay. Now, the next thing is there's some things I know that don't work, and that's asphalt shingles. It's like a heat battery, and radiant barriers just kind of tickle at that problem. And
wait, Bobby,
that's insulated directly under it.
Bobby, what you're saying is that a radiant barrier is just a way to kind of ameliorate the
right.
asphalt shingle, which shouldn't be used as a roofing material in the first place. You're saying
right? Should be highways or something else.
Uh huh.
And a radiant barrier is excellent. Okay, now I'll just run through a couple things that I know that are bad and good, and you know a way to. Okay, an aluminum roof, actually the aluminum just reflects 95% right off the bat,
mm-hmm.
and if you insulate directly under it, you get excellent both summer and winter. The problem is you don't get incoming heat in the winter. Now, okay, the next thing is the insulation. Fiberglass is the most god-awful thing I've ever heard of. It should be illegal to own it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nasty. It makes me so sick to think about it. I'll probably itch after talking here.
Mm-hmm.
But I found out that cellulose insulation, you have no roaches. It's a fire retardant. Mice don't like it. They won't live in it. And it turns your house into a thermos bottle, and it soundproofs much better than any fiberglass. The only place I like fiberglass.
Keep going, Bobby. I like the things you're pointing out. What you're saying is that even in the building code, are you breathing in the phone, Bobby?
I'm sorry. I'm having trouble hearing you.
Okay. What you're saying is that even in the building code upgrade, you think mistakes are being made and that proper materials should be specified. You think roofs should be made out of aluminum and insulation should be cellulose. So we should do away with asphalt roofs and we should do away with fiberglass insulation. What else?
Okay, an aluminum roof is fine. They're about three times more expensive than another kind of roof.
Yep.
Maybe. But a metal roof directly insulated is very good. In my house, I have that. I have both kinds in different parts, and the aluminum is excellent. The other one is really good, too, and it works very well. My attic is like being outside under a shade tree in the summer if you open the windows at each end.
Mm.
So it's very good. The next thing... Okay, I'll be real fast. Double hang, double glazed glass. That's silly not to know. But if you put your air conditioner in the attic, this is very dumb because this is where the heat is, and why would you put the heat remover in the place where there's more heat anyway?
So we need to create an alternative space in homes to contain the air conditioning units. Where would that be?
Well, either some houses have the vertical units, which are in the hallway,
uh-huh.
Air return.
Yep.
You know, and there's problems with that, too, where the air return comes from, the floor or the ceiling. But those problems are simple technical problems. Another way is just have an equipment room where you designate this is where the water heater goes, and this is where the furnace goes, and this is where the air conditioner goes, and here's where the water softener goes, which mm-hmm. is a very good thing, too, the water softener. These things have been neglected for years, and I don't understand why. I guess it's because of the wholesalers don't like to change. They don't like to change. The wholesalers of petroleum don't like to change and coal. These people, you know, that's just generic.
Yeah, but I mean, if the city of Houston said no equipment may go in the attic, it must go into a separate equipment room. You know, done. It's done, right? It's a done deal. No house will pass inspection without that being the place where those things go, right?
Then they would blame that extra expense on me, but I think it would be a wonderful legacy. And,
yep.
And fine, blame it on me because I think it would work better.
Bobby, thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, we just got a few minutes left. Let's take Rachel next. Rachel, welcome to the New Capital Show.
Thank you. I've really enjoyed the program over the many weeks and months.
Thank you.
I've been curious for years about the acres and acres and acres of new suburban developments with black roofs out on the prairie. No trees. If there's any trees to begin with, they're bulldozed.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got these houses crammed next to each other with black roofs,
mm-hmm.
black asphalt shingles. I mean, can we put some solar collectors? Can we use white instead of black roofs? We re-roofed our house some years ago and put on a light color roof.
Did it make a difference?
Yes. I mean, if nothing else, it helps. You'd think it would help with just the heat sink effect of the entire metropolitan area.
But I mean, did you notice either any decrease in your bill, or was the house more comfortable at a different temperature?
Well, I'll tell you, I can't answer that fully because we put the new roof on the same time we did a bunch of other work.
Mm-hmm.
And we really upgraded the house at that
time.
So
you had several variables in motion at the same time.
Beg pardon?
You had several variables in motion at the same time, so you can't tell.
Variables. However, yeah. Our neighbors next door saw our new roof, and they had to replace theirs, and they put a light color roof on, and they noticed the difference in their comfort and utility.
Mm-hmm.
So... it may not be scientific, but it just seems counterintuitive to put a black roof out on the prairie.
Yeah, okay, Thomas Glenn wants to jump in here.
Well, Rachel hit upon a real sensitive subject right now. You know, the vast majority of the new homes that are being built in the greater Houston area are not in the city of Houston.
Right.
And you have, some smaller cities that are, you know, on the outskirts of the city of Houston. And we still have some work to do there as well to encourage those cities to adopt new building codes.
Are you seeing anything happen there? Are you seeing suburban cities that are not incorporated within Houston have their own incorporation, have their own set of codes? Are they receptive to discussions with environmental defense or anyone else?
We have to make more of an outreach to those cities right now. We've been focusing on the city of Houston and the school districts here and working with the home builders. again, you know, I've been on the job 3 months, and it is, you know, I like to work behind my bosses in Austin. There are a lot of things and a lot of individuals and entities in this city that you have to get a hold of. We're having to work with a lot of different things. But also, the state of Texas has to do more in regards to building code. And a lot of people don't even know that there is a state building code for residential and commercial. But there, some of those codes need to be, both of those codes need to be updated to address unincorporated areas. And this region has a lot of those. And I mean, growing up here, I remember that a lot of people reside in unincorporated areas. Heck, I live in a house right now. Yeah. I'm not in the city at all.
Rachel, thanks for your call.
Yeah, one quick thing.
Real quick.
There's an old house in our neighborhood with a roof made from old World War II airplane wings.
Mm. Airplane wings.
Wow.
Yep. They got it for scrap, made a metal roof, out of it. Works fine.
Wow. That's, I'm sure Bobby would like to, would appreciate hearing that with his suggestion that metal roofs are far better for energy efficiency, and I think he's right. Rachel, thank you for the call. Thomas Glenn, we've just got a couple more minutes here. How should we finish up today? People should take matters into their own hands. They need to make these upgrades. They need to look at spending some money and making investment in their house to make it more energy efficient. Should they wait for the building codes to change? What's a person to do when they look at their dwelling?
We're going to stick on dwelling. I'm hoping I get a chance to come back and talk about some other things down the road.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation has been great. And it's obvious that your listeners have been thinking about this for a while. One of the things to do if you reside within the city of Houston, come January of 2008, the city is going to start undertaking adopting new building codes through city council. I encourage everybody that is out there that is either a resident, commercial building owner, taxpayer, or whomever, to call your city council person, work with council, go testify on things that matter to you. Also, you know, if you're looking at buying a new home, demand that home builders do more than what they're doing now.
Mm-hmm.
We're working with them. I think there are some opportunities there that, you know, folks will benefit from down the road, but you have to make the effort to ask for more. And in regards to existing, for those that are able to work with CenterPoint Energy, they have, energy efficiency programs, but they're mainly for low-income people. So those that are a lower income status.
There may be a program for you. Seek it out. There are things that can be done.
There.
Well, Thomas Glenn, I want to thank you very much for being my guest today. And I want to wish all of you a very, very happy New Year. This is going to be the last show of 2007. We look forward, as I said earlier, to a great 2008. I hope you've had a wonderful year. I hope you will have a wonderful year. And I wish you all peace, prosperity, and much happiness and joy in the upcoming year. This has been another edition of the New Capital Show. I am Leo Gold. www.newcapitalshow.com. You can find us there as well as on Apple's iTunes. Coming up in just a few minutes, the gang from Thresholds. Take care.
Politics, economics, consolidation, health, and the environment are issues people face all over the world.
And we're all a part of that world.
So how do you sort it all out?
Understanding what's going on in the world today is not that easy.
Finding independent music, news, and information is just as tough.
And that's why you listen to KPFT.
You get news, music, and ways that help you to be a more informed and enriched citizen of the world.
This understanding is important to you.
And is delivered each day by KPFT.
Your regular support makes this kind of music and news possible.
Over 90% of our budget comes from listeners. Without you, KPFT would vanish.
So visit kpft.org to make your pledge of support anytime.
You're listening to
commercial-free, listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio.
KPFT Houston.
Mm-hmm. This is the time of year when we think about giving. We take time to appreciate the family and friends who make our lives happier and richer. Now's a good time to think about giving back. KPFT has been here for you all year with programming you've come to depend on. We've informed you, entertained you, and hopefully made your year happier and richer as a result. Your support made it possible and can make it possible for another full year. At this time, please give back with a call to our membership department at 713-526-4000, extension 314, or pledge online today at kpft.org. Help us end this year with your support. Call to our membership department at 713-526-4000.
The free program you just heard was paid for by the listener members of KPFT Houston. If you're not already a KPFT member, we encourage you to join with us in keeping free speech alive by becoming one. Basic membership is still $35 a year. You don't have to, but you'll feel better. Thanks for listening.